Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be found on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net. I'm your host, Jacob Lee. This week on Journeys, Father James Early. Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy. I'm your host, Jacob Lee, and today joining me via the phone is Father James Early. How are you doing, Father?
I am doing better than I deserve. Thank you, Jacob. How are you?
Very good. And Father, you're down in hurricane country.
Yes, I am. Good old Houston, Texas.
And thank God you had a small storm, not a large storm.
Yes, we had another one of these storms coming right at us, and we had no idea what it was going to do. Fortunately, it passed us by, just gave us a little bit of rain, and went right on its merry way.
Now, Father, you're with what parish and what part of Houston? Is it a suburb? Or give us the details of where you're located.
I am the assistant priest at St. Joseph's Antiochian Orthodox Church. It is in the Houston city limits, which, as you, I'm sure you know, are very large, and is on the west side of town. Interestingly enough, I thought I might mention that we are the only Orthodox parish in the entire world named in honor of St. Joseph the Betrothed, unless one has been built in the last year or two, and I didn't know about it.
Wow. And, Father, you have a blog?
Yes, I do. I have a humble little blog I try to keep up on a regular basis. It's called St. James Kids. And I can give them more information on that later if you'd like.
No problem. And you have a forthcoming book.
Yes, that is correct as well. I had, when I first came down here, and especially after I became a deacon and then a priest, I must have had 10 or 12 people over a period of a couple of years. Once they heard my story of how I became Orthodox, they would say, well, Deacon James or Father James, you should write that up. You should write about it. And so I did. And really, the reason I started the blog, part of the reason I started the blog was so that I could break it down into manageable chunks, because I really don't like to write. And the idea of writing an entire book was a little bit scary for me. So I thought, well, I can do one page today. And then 2 days, I'll do another page. And 2 more days, I'll do another page. And so I kept this up for about 6 months. I came up with about 60 pages double-spaced, 30 or so single-spaced, and thought, well, what the heck, I'll try to get it published. So I got it. I found a publisher who would accept it. They wanted me to lengthen it a little, so I doubled it to about 120 pages. And it's Regina Orthodox Press, which is one of my favorite Orthodox publishers, and it's scheduled to come out in January. It's called From Baptist to Bosnia to Byzantium.
Well, and I think that's why we're talking today. So this, we're going to talk about your journey from Baptist to Bosnia to Byzantium. And Father James, let's go back in time before we even get to your Baptist roots. I've read through your material. I don't think you started out life as a Baptist. How did you start out? What was the religion of your parents?
Well, I most certainly did not start out life as a Baptist. My mother would never have stood for that. Really, I was raised as pretty much nothing. My father had been raised in a fairly strict Methodist home, but he left that very early on. My parents were a lot older than me. I have to give you a little bit of background. I was born in 1968, but my father was born in 1919, and my mother was born in 1921. So they grew up during the Depression and were very much self-made people. My dad worked his way through college, then he went into the Marines. He fought in World War II in the Pacific Theater for 4 years. And so he was a really tough customer, and the war really shook him up, and it really kind of shook his faith, what little faith he had. He used to say to me things like, well, I saw some really wonderful people get killed, and I saw some total jerks live. And so he was not a very strong believer. He believed in God, but he really didn't have a lot of use for the church. I think he read the Bible every now and then, so he really never went to church as an adult. My mom had been raised Episcopalian, and she really didn't go very much either. I think she went more than Dad. But so anyway, growing up, I was raised in a pretty secular environment. I do not remember really ever going to church. I did go to an Episcopal preschool for maybe half a year or so, but I think occasionally we'd go on Christmas, maybe even Easter, but I was pretty much raised nothing. Almost never went to church until I got into high school.
And what changed that you decided in high school it was time to go to church after growing up in a secular home?
Well, it's kind of funny. What changed is I met a girl. And I was a freshman in high school, and I didn't know anybody. You know, when you're a fish, you're on the bottom of the totem pole, so to speak. I wasn't popular. I wasn't all that good looking. I had no athletic ability whatsoever. I didn't really have all that much going for me. And I met a girl who was a sophomore who was good looking and pretty popular. And she actually, for some reason, decided she liked me. But she was in a very strict Church of Christ family. And she said, "Well, James, if you're going to go with me," you remember that phrase, going together? I couldn't even drive, so it's not like we were dating or anything, but she said, "If we're going to go together, then you have to go to church with me." And I thought about it, and I really didn't want to do that. I had no interest in the church whatsoever, but I said, "Well, I think this girl is well worth a few church services."
So you went?
Yes, I did. I went, and I was surprised to find that I really kind of liked it, especially the sermon. You know, as you know, the Church of Christ is a very evangelical Protestant denomination, has its own little quirks, but it's very centered on preaching, and I liked the things I heard from the preacher. So I, even though I wasn't all that wild about going, I really wasn't all that resistant to it either. But eventually that relationship fell apart, and then a year later, it's really kind of funny, and my wife gives me a hard time about this all the time. About a year later, I found myself dating this girl's younger sister. And so there I was, a year later, in the same church, sitting in the same pew, sitting beside a different girl this time. I was listening to the same preacher and hearing the same hymns and everything, instrumental, of course. And again, I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. At the same time, I had two guy friends who were Southern Baptists. One of them was a preacher's kid, and he wasn't very wild like the stereotypical preacher's kid. He was pretty devout Christian, and so was the other guy. And these two guys would take me, they'd invite me to youth events all the time. And I remember saying to them, they'd say, "Hey, James, you want to go to this youth retreat or youth whatever this weekend?" And I would say, "Is there going to be food there?" And they'd say, "Yes." And I'd say, "All right, I'm there." So it was the power of pizza in that case that brought me in. And so again, you know, I would hear messages, preaching, Bible studies, things like that, and it really started to get through to me. I'd never heard anything like this before, and it was most of the preaching was pretty positive. You know, it wasn't all hellfire and damnation, although there was some of that certainly. But it was very interesting, and it kind of inspired me to maybe read the Bible myself, look into things, maybe start attending a church myself.
And so that put you on your journey. Now, so your first church was a Church of Christ kind of introduction. But
yeah, it was. You know, I visited the Church of Christ occasionally. The relationship with the second sister eventually fell apart too. And I later was, you know, I had a couple other friends who were also Southern Baptists. So the Southern Baptist, I kind of lost that Church of Christ connection, but stayed plugged in with Southern Baptists. And the thing was, is, again, my mother was very anti-Baptist and just anti-Holy Roller, as she used to say. She was a good Episcopalian, you know, back traditional Episcopalian who liked things in order, structured, liturgy, calmness, propriety, you know, not all this wild, crazy hellfire and damnation preaching and everything. So I said to Mom, I said, "Hey, Mom, I want to start going to church." And she said, "Okay, we will go to our Episcopal church. So we did. We started attending the Episcopal church in the town where I grew up. I grew up in Pasadena, Texas, which is the largest suburb of Houston, just southeast of Houston. And so we started going to the Episcopal church. So actually my first regular church experience was in the Episcopal church, although I continued to attend not so much Church of Christ, but Southern Baptist youth activities, and occasionally a service, occasionally a revival from time to time.
Well, and Southern Baptist is the predominant religion of Texas, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And in fact, even the town that I grew up in, Pasadena, I mean, it must have been half Baptist at least. It just seemed like every other kid I knew was a Baptist of one stripe or another, mainly Southern Baptist. And there was a Baptist church on every corner.
Yeah, and a Methodist one across the street, typically.
Yeah, but there were the Methodists were outnumbered at least 2-1.
Yeah. So you started attending the Episcopal church. You're doing these retreats and youth groups with the Baptist guys, and it seems like food's a big connection there.
Yes, it was. You know, I've always loved to eat. I still do. But it was a very interesting experience because I would go into the Episcopal service, and you know, even though it's liturgical, that just didn't really connect with me at that young age. You know, we're talking, I was 15, 16, 17. I went to the Episcopal church almost every Sunday all through high school. And I'm going to the Episcopal church, and the liturgy seemed dry and boring. None of it was sung. It was, you know, it was all spoken pretty much. There were contrasts between what I was seeing in the Episcopal church and what I was seeing in the Baptist activities and the service when I would attend. The Episcopal service, or the Episcopal parish that I attended, was not, or at least it doesn't seem like it was one of these real liberal ones. But interestingly enough, the pastor of the church, and he's a wonderful man, and I love him to this day, but he was a literature major in college, and he loved literature, and it seemed like every Sunday he would go up there and he'd start to preach the sermon, and he would say, well, you know, this passage reminds me of this play by Samuel Beckett or this play by Shakespeare or whatever, and he would talk about the literary theme of the passage, and he would just get all literary on me. I never was a big literature guy anyway, and it just seemed like it was more like a lecture in an English class than a sermon. And then I would go to the Baptist, the youth events and the services, and they're preaching about, you know, we need to receive Jesus. We need to, live our life for God. We need to read our Bible. We need to pray. And they started talking about this concept that I'd never heard of in my life. They kept saying, I needed to get saved. You know, I needed to get saved. I needed to give my life to Jesus. So, and I did over and over and over again. You know, I would sign the card, raise my hand, but nothing really ever came out of it. It was all emotional. And then another thing that I saw was in my Episcopal parish, there was a youth group, and I was somewhat involved in it, but these kids would say, hey, what'd you do last night? Oh, man, we went out and got drunk, and we partied, and we yada, yada, yada. And it just seemed like the kids there weren't serious about living the Christian faith at all, whereas the kids in the Baptist church, for the most part, the ones I knew were.
And so you eventually drifted away from the Episcopal church, and sometime in college you discovered?
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's when kids start weirding out. Not when they start, but they tend to finalize the process. Yeah, I went to college, and what I did was my freshman year, I lived on campus the first semester, and I didn't have a car, and I said, I'm just going to go to every church of every denomination that's within walking distance. I didn't quite do that. Like, I ruled out the Catholic Church. I wasn't going to be Roman Catholic. I wasn't going to do anything that's totally bizarre, or at least it seemed bizarre, like the Mormon Church or anything like that. But I visited a Methodist church, a Baptist church, an Episcopal church, a Christian church, several others like that, whatever I could get to on my feet. I visited different things. But again, I just didn't really find anything that was really all that exciting to me, or that it just really connect. I shouldn't use the word exciting, but it just didn't connect. And then after my first semester, I moved off campus, but not far, maybe a mile from campus, in an apartment. And right down the street from my apartment was a great big Southern Baptist church. It's Hyde Park Baptist Church, still there. And at the time, they had about 10,000 members. I think it's bigger now, a little bit bigger. And so I thought, well, what the heck? I can walk down to Hyde Park in 5 minutes, so I'll go to their services. And I did. And I can't say I went every Sunday, but I went pretty often. And they had a really great preacher. And again, the preaching was really what drew me. I don't think I ever went to Sunday school at this point, but I really, was the preaching it connected with me. It just seemed very life-based, very practical. And then later, after my freshman year, I moved way off campus, but by that time I had a car, so I would drive in and continue going to Hyde Park. And, within about a year of starting college, I'd pretty much decided the Episcopal Church wasn't for me anymore. And I told my mom, and she was very upset, angry with me, very, very depressed. I was leaving the church of our family and so on and so on. But eventually we reconciled and agreed to disagree. And so I attended mainly the Baptist church. Occasionally I would go to a Bible church or something like that. But I finally, I had realized for a long time that I had wanted to be a Christian, but I hadn't wanted to make the sacrifices necessary to do it. I wanted to kind of have my cake and eat it too. I wanted to go to church. I wanted to hear the words of the Lord, and I wanted to sing the hymns and hear everything. But at the same time, I wanted to just be able to live my life any way I wanted to. I didn't want to have to follow the Lord's commandments. And, it's funny, I had a couple of friends who were really agnostics that kind of helped snap me into realizing that that was an untenable position. But I'll give you an example. When I was a senior in high school, and I'm going back a little bit, I went through a stage where I carried a New Testament around in my pocket. And I happened to say to this friend of mine who was agnostic, I said, "Hey, how do you think this looks?" And he says, "I think it looks terrible." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I don't think you really live your life for God. You're just doing that for show." And that really hit me. And he was right. And then I had my first roommate at college was also agnostic, and I lived a pretty fairly wild life, medium wild for a college student these days, but I would do things, and he would say, you listen to Christian music, you read the Bible, you go to church, and yet you do all these crazy things. Why is that? And I said, "Well, God will forgive me no matter what I do." And he said, "Well, don't you think that's kind of presuming upon God? Don't you think that's a little presumptuous and arrogant on your part?" And I thought, he's right. So those kind of things just sunk in. They stuck with me, and I just continued to read the scriptures, and I can't say I had this massive conversion moment. I didn't have a burning bush or a Damascus road. I didn't have a 900-foot Jesus appear in front of me. I wasn't in the gutter and, strung out on drugs or anything, but I just realized, I'm going to have to make a decision. Am I going to follow Christ, or am I going to continue to try to live a double life and have my cake and eat it too? And so, this is 1989. I was almost 21. They gave the altar call at Hyde Park like they always did, and I walked forward and officially, formally, I guess, received Jesus as my Lord and Savior. But again, for me, it was more of a gradual process. But I was baptized about a week later. And from then on, I was officially Southern Baptist.
So you took on the Southern Baptist mantle.
I did, and I jumped in with both feet. I said, if I'm going to do this, I've always kind of been that way. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it all. And so I not only went every Sunday morning, I went to Sunday school and church, and then I went to the Sunday night service. I even joined the college choir, and they had this Bible study on Friday nights. They would call it Friday Night Bible Study, very original name. And it would be held at the house of a different church member. It would move around from week to week. And they had food, which, of course, as you know by now, was always a plus for me. And so I started going to this thing. You know, it's kind of counterintuitive because most people on Friday night want to go party, especially most college students. But I thought, well, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And again, I liked it. It was very good, good studies. And one day, you didn't ask this question, but I'm just going to go ahead and throw it in anyway. One day, we were going through the food line getting our dinner, and I sat down at this table. It was a small table, and there were three other girls with me, which, of course, I always liked that, too. But across from me was a fairly short, blonde-headed girl, and we got to talking and became friends, and about 3 months later started dating, and that girl would eventually become my wife, Jennifer, and we've been married now for 18 years.
Well, and according to your blog post here that I have in front of me, it says that she was fairly attractive as well, not just kind of short and blonde. But
yes, I'm sorry, I failed to mention that. Yes, Jennifer, if you're listening, forgive me. But yes, I believe so.
There you go. And well, so you found your wife going to the Baptist Bible study, and you graduated college and moved off. Where'd you end up in?
Yes, I ended up taking. I was an electrical engineering major, although I really didn't want to be, but I stayed in engineering for a variety of reasons. The main reason was my dad pretty much made me.
Good reason.
I really wanted to get into history, but anyway, he said, you need to get a job, son, and get out there and work. So I did, and unfortunately the Texas economy kind of bit the dust in 1990, which is the year I graduated, and I couldn't get a job in Texas. You know, I could not get a firm offer in Texas. I got really only two firm offers. I got one in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I was going to be doing computer programming, which I despised, no offense. And the other one was at a paper mill in South Carolina. You know, and being a good Southerner, of course, I chose South Carolina. So we packed up, moved out to South Carolina, all the way over the coast. We lived near the town of Georgetown, which is about an hour's drive north of Charleston. And I worked in a paper mill. And it was interesting because during college, I really hadn't grown very much spiritually. You know, I had gone forward, prayed the prayer, signed the card, got myself dunked and everything. I mean, I'd gone through all the, jumped through all the hoops to be a Baptist in good standing. But on the inside, I was really much more or less the same person. I mean, I had a desire, you know, I'd made a commitment to Christ, but I really didn't understand what it meant to be a disciple of Christ. No one ever took me to the side and said, hey, son, let's sit down and talk about this. And nobody ever really mentored me or anything like that. And I didn't really know I was supposed to be seeking somebody out. So, you know, it's not like I lived a horrible, wicked life, but I just really lived a life that was more centered on self than on the Lord. But when we moved to South Carolina, you know, I was out of my environment. It was kind of like a different culture. I mean, it's similar to Texas, but very, very different in many ways. And there I was with my wife. You know, before long we had a child, and all we had, it was a little bitty town of 10,000. In fact, we lived north of there in a town of 1,000. And there was nothing to do except go to church, at least that we were going to do. And so we got really active in our church and, more and more active. And then, you know, I never really liked my job. And my dad said, give it a chance, son, give it a chance. So I said, all right, I'm going to give it a chance. I gave it about a year, and I just really said, I said, Jennifer, I cannot do this. And she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I love history. I think I'm going to become a history professor. And she said, that sounds great. So I started applying to some master's programs. I was going to go get a master's and PhD in history. We missed our families incredibly. We missed Texas, so we were going to come back to Texas. I had it all planned out, you know, I was going to become a history professor. And I mentioned this to my pastor and said, what do you think? And he said, well, have you ever considered becoming a seminary history professor, like teaching church history? And I said, no, I never really thought about that. He said, well, why don't you send off for a catalog from Southwestern Seminary, which is it's in Fort Worth. It's the largest Southern Baptist seminary. In fact, it's the largest seminary in the world of any type, and Christian seminary. And so I said, okay, I'll send off for the catalog. And I got the catalog and started flipping through it, and I realized if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to become a seminary history professor, I'm going to have to take Greek, I'm going to have to take Hebrew, I'm going to have to take philosophy of religion and all this other junk, and, you know, I'm not really all that interested. I just want to take history, you know, all this other junk. So I said, well, heck with that, and I took the catalog and I filed it away on my shelf, figured I'd never see it again. And then, it's funny that the Lord, I mentioned this in my book, the Lord always works, almost always works through books. He always speaks, again, I shouldn't say always, he almost always speaks to me through books. And one day, I had a little bitty cough, so I thought, eh, I'll stay home from work. It didn't take much to keep me away from that job, because I really didn't like it. And so I stayed home, I wasn't feeling all that well, I was sitting at my desk, and I don't know how to describe this other than I looked at the catalog and I knew just like that, that's where I'm going, that's what I'm going to do. You know, I did not hear an audible voice from God, but I just felt like I had been struck by a lightning bolt, as if a neon sign had flashed and said, this is it. So I lost all my desire to do regular history. And I just knew. Again, I don't know how. It's impossible to explain. But I knew that God wanted me to go to seminary, to that seminary. I didn't know what else. I just knew that I was supposed to go to seminary.
So you packed the family up and headed for Fort Worth.
We did. 8 months later, we took a little time to pay off some debt and wait till the next fall. So we packed up, quit our jobs. I didn't have any job whatsoever lined up. I was a very lousy engineer, so I knew I wasn't going to get an engineering job. And it was tough. You know, it was really tough. There were times when we were struggling with the decision that I thought, well, I said to Jennifer one time, I said, Jennifer, we can't do this. I just added up all the numbers. Here are all our expenses, and here is the money we're going to be able to make. And the expenses are greater than the money that we're going to make. We're not going to be able to do it. We cannot do it. And she looked at me and she said, James, don't you think if God calls you that he's going to provide for you? You know, I thought, well, duh, I guess he is. You know, I guess God's not going to call me to do something and then throw me to the wolves and not and let me starve. So we did it. We packed up, moved back. We got minimum wage jobs. She got a job full-time working at a daycare. I got a job painting houses for the seminary, painting seminary properties and so on. So we were at Southwestern Seminary for 4 years, and I struggled with what to do. I didn't know, you know, God, I know you wanted me to come here, but what am I supposed to do? And I just thought, well, I guess I'm going to get me a church like everybody else. I guess I'll be a preacher boy, you know, get me a country church and do that until I graduate and then go get me hopefully a bigger church and so on and so on, move up the Baptist career chain like a lot of people do. And that turned out not to be the case. You know, it seemed to me that God closed that door. I actually did go and preach, as we used to say, in view of a call. You know, that I preached before a group of people, a small group of people from a small country Baptist church. And they liked me, and they called me back for a second time. But then after the second time, I guess they didn't like me that much. They didn't call me. And I had tried, I'd sent out other resumes. I'd tried and tried and tried to get a church of my own where I could pastor it, and it just didn't work. So I thought, well, I guess I'm not going to be doing that. And I used to say to myself, I don't know if I ever said this out loud to Jennifer, but I used to say, you know, the one thing I'm not going to do is go overseas and be one of these crazy foreign missionaries. I am not going to be a foreign missionary. My first year in seminary, they had this missions conference, and which they do that every year. I assume they probably still do, but the Southern Baptist Convention is very organized and centralized, and the missionaries are not supported by just one church or by a group of people. They don't have to raise their own support. I just might mention for your listeners that just the way it works is all the churches send some of their offerings and tithes that they bring in. They send them to a central location, and then that it's called the cooperative program, and that program funds the missionaries and the seminaries and everything. So it's really more like, again, it's very centralized. And so the mission board, at that time it was called the Foreign Mission Board. They came out to the seminary and were doing this big mission conference. And everybody was talking about it. Everybody's excited. You know, are you going to go? Are you going to go, James? I said, no, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to get swept up in a wave of emotion because let's face it, the primary purpose of this was to try to recruit missionaries. And I said, I'm not going to get swept up and find myself walking down the aisle and signing up to go to Africa or Asia or something like that. I'm not going to do it. So I did not go. And I said, afterwards, I said, man, I really dodged that bullet. But the funny thing about it is that the bullet ended up being more like a boomerang. It came back and hit me because I was sitting doing something very innocuous, or so it seemed. I was reading a book on Baptist history. Yes, we had to take a course on Baptist history, and we had to read a book that was about 600 pages. And I was reading about Baptist beginnings in Eastern Europe and how some of the, like the German Baptists used to send people into Russia and the Balkans and all and try to, you know, win people the Lord, quote unquote, start Baptist churches and so on and so on. And I just sensed, again, I sensed a voice, not an audible voice, but an inner voice, the still small voice, saying that is where you're going to go and that is what you're going to do. And so I said to Jennifer, you know what, I hate to tell you this, but I think I'm feeling a calling into foreign missions. And she really struggled with that too, because we had a daughter who was about, I guess, about 2 years old at the time. And she was concerned about our daughter, you know, how's she going to eat? You know, where's she going to go to school? Those kind of issues. As every parent that's called into missions probably struggles with this. And one day she was reading in Matthew, the Gospel of St. Matthew, and she came across the part where Jesus says, if one of you, you know, if your son asks you for bread, are you going to give him a stone? And so on and so on. And he says, if you then being evil know how to give good gifts, then how much more will your Heavenly Father give to those who love him? I'm paraphrasing, but anyway. And she was assured at that point. So we decided from then on that we were going to go into foreign missions.
Well, and if I can take you back real quick, I think there was two things in your history there in your seminary that probably two seeds that were planted about orthodoxy.
Yes.
One of them was you had a lot of questions that were left unanswered.
Yes, that is true. Let me just—I'll kind of take you on to the end of seminary. You know, I decided, well, I need to start preparing for missions. So, in fact, the semester after I sensed that call into foreign missions to Eastern Europe. I was pretty sure it was Eastern Europe at that point, because by this time, you know, the Berlin Wall had been down for a few years, and the Soviet Union had fallen, and you hear these stories about all these preachers going over there and handing out Bibles, and people are mobbing them, trying to get the Bibles, and so on. So there was a lot of excitement about Eastern Europe among Southern Baptists. You know, it's like, man, it's finally opened, and now we can really take the gospel to them. You know, it's a little bit naive and arrogant, but that was the thought. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I remember I was in a non-denominational church, but that was the same. We were sending missionaries like crazy to Eastern Europe.
Everybody all of a sudden wanted to go over there and strike while the iron is hot, so to speak. Yeah, you've been there, done that. So I took this class. There was a visiting professor from Romania who was actually a Romanian Baptist, and he was teaching a class called Missions in Eastern Europe. And really, it was more like missions in Romania, because he didn't really know much about the other parts, but he knew a lot about Romania. So he taught us about Romania, and he assigned one of the textbooks we were assigned to read was The Orthodox Church by, you know, at that time I knew him as Timothy Ware. So it's funny because he assigned the book to read, but he did not test us over it. And the funny thing is at the seminary, that would happen a lot. You know, like a professor, like you'd be taking a class on church history, and the professor maybe wrote a book on church growth, and he would make you buy the book and read it, but he'd never test you on it, you know, because he wanted to sell more books. So I remember one professor told me, well, it doesn't hurt you very much, and it really helps me a lot. he was a good guy anyway, but see, we had to sign a statement at the end of each semester, an honor statement saying, yes, I have read all the assigned material. And we used to hear stories about people 10 years later writing to the seminary saying, oh, I've got to confess that I didn't read my book on the Orthodox Church or whatever, or on church growth. back in my second semester. Please, enclosed is my diploma. Please accept it. Things like that. So I just didn't want to have to hassle with that. So I said, okay, the guy's not going to test us. I have no interest in orthodoxy whatsoever, but I'm supposed to read this book. So I took the book, and one weekend I was visiting with my in-laws, and I just went up and in this upper room that they have, like a loft. I was all by myself, and I slapped through the whole thing in one weekend. And I closed it. I said, okay, I've read it. I can sign the paper. And, you know, obviously, if you try to read that book in one weekend, you're not going to get a whole lot out of it. So I didn't really make much of an impression on me at the time. I remember seeing a video. I remember hearing the term theosis. It was the first time I really learned anything about orthodoxy. But it was really more like, okay, here's what the people there believe, and here's what you're going to have to learn about so you convince them to be good Baptists, or at least be good evangelicals so that you can turn them away. It was really more like the principle of know thy enemy. Yeah, so that was a seed planted about orthodoxy, but not much of a seed, just a seed of awareness. And then you talked about, also, you asked about questions I had unanswered. You know, I took classes on New Testament, Old Testament, all that, you know, the kind of stuff you would take. There were just so many passages in the New Testament that just didn't seem to make sense. You know, Southern Baptists will fight and die over two or three issues. One of them, of course, is sola scriptura, that the scriptures are the only valid source of authority, the only completely trustworthy source. Sola fide, salvation is, and justification is by faith alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, you know all this. Same as all Protestants. But another thing is they're really big on is no infant baptism. But, you know, the thing about faith and works, I remember reading a passage in the book of James, the Epistle of St. James, 2:24, which is, you know, this gets pointed out a lot, but I might as well point out again. James 2:24 is the only part of the entire Bible that uses the phrase faith alone or faith only. And it says, you know, so you see then, brethren, that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. And I thought, you know, that doesn't make any sense, because St. Paul, at least I thought at the time, and I'd been taught this, St. Paul clearly teaches, the Bible from beginning to end clearly teaches that salvation is by faith alone. So how does this fit into it? And I never really resolved that, so I did what most of my professors and my colleagues and my fellow students did. I just ignored it.
So anyway, convenient scripture to ignore.
Yeah, I didn't underline that one. You know, we always joke about the passages I underlined and didn't underline. Yeah, didn't underline that one, didn't highlight it. So that, you know, that pretty much brought us up to the end of seminary.
And then you decided to hit the missions field, and you went to the beautiful city of Prague.
I did, yes. We had sensed very early on from the beginning, from the beginning of the time we felt called as missionaries, we felt that we were called to Eastern Europe, but we didn't know what country, and I don't know why, I can't explain it, but we both felt like it was going to be one of the smaller countries, not Russia. Maybe it was because Russia was getting so much attention, everybody and their dog wanted to go to Russia. So we didn't know which one. I mean, there's so many little countries there, and we started studying them and trying to figure out, you know, learn a little bit about all the countries. I also decided I was going to go on a short-term mission trip. I looked around, and, you know, you would see, okay, there was a little board where you would go look. People would post up, okay, I need 10 people to go to Kenya. I need 10 people to go to Thailand. I need 5 people to go to wherever, you name it. And none of them were Eastern Europe. And finally, one of them was Prague, Czech Republic. And I thought, well, that's Eastern Europe, so I'll go. So I went, and I was really struck by the hospitality of the Czech people. They were kind and warm, and had a great experience. So, and while I was there, I met a foreign mission board missionary to Prague who said, hey, you know, I've been wanting somebody to come up here and help me do student work among English-speaking students. Prague has thousands of international students that come over here and they take classes in English. They come from all over the world. He said, I am pastoring a church and I can't really do that much with them, so I want a helper, a student worker. So I said, okay, sign me up. So he wrote me a job request, and we finished up seminary, as I mentioned, and we went on over there. We found out about, actually, during our training, we did about a short training, maybe 10 days before we went over there. Actually, I think it was more like 3 weeks, but it doesn't matter. He called me and he said, you know what, I hate to tell you this, but we're going to resign. We're leaving the field. I said, oh, great, this guy, you know, he was going to be the brains of the organization. He was going to tell me what to do, where to go, all this, and now he's leaving. So we got up there, and he was there for about 5 days overlap with us, just enough time to show us where to eat, how to get on the subway, and all that stuff. And then they were gone, and we were there all by ourselves. And then we had another couple come in. They transferred over from Finland by way of Denmark. They'd been in Denmark for about a year but spent 10 years in Finland. And they didn't know anything about Prague. They didn't understand the Czech people, the Czech culture. But the husband was going to be the pastor of our church. It was an English-language church, International Baptist Church of Prague, which is, of course, still there. And so I did whatever I could. I thought, well, I don't know where the students are. Nobody's here to help me. I gradually did research, and I finally found some students, and I started a little bit of a ministry. You know, I found a dorm where they had all English-speaking students. The thing about universities in Europe, as I'm sure you discovered when you were in Ireland, I don't know if it's the same way in Ireland, but in most of Europe that I've been in, it's not like, okay, here is the campus. Here's the 40 acres, or here's the 100 acres, and this is where all the buildings are. Here's where all the students are. It's not like that. They're very decentralized. They're spread out. And so I couldn't find any students. I finally tracked down a Campus Crusade guy, and he helped me find some people. So I was working with some English-speaking students. Some of them were American. Some were European. And I helped the pastor out. I helped lead worship. I preached when he was gone. I just did whatever. But it just really wasn't a very satisfying ministry. It's not like, and it was kind of tough to live there too. And I talk about this some in the book. I won't go into much detail, but man, it was cold. I mean, we were Texas people through and through, you know, and we were not used to negative 23 degrees. I can't remember if that was Celsius or Fahrenheit. It doesn't matter. It's negative 23. It's just flat out cold.
Yeah, negative 23 is not fun no matter what.
Yeah. It's just flat out cold. And so we were struggling. We were having a hard time. You know, I kind of butted heads with my pastor over worship issues and things like that. And so it just, I don't know. There was this, it wasn't like, oh, man, we're just loving what we're doing. We finally did get something going. But what happened in the meantime is we heard about Bosnia. Bosnia had just opened up in the sense that the war had ended. The war in Bosnia ended in November of 1995. And the IMB, of course, wanted to rush people in there and do what they could. They were trying to find people, but they couldn't get anybody to go down there. Surprise, surprise, nobody wanted to go into a war zone or a former war zone. And the war only stopped because NATO and UN troops went in there. So they were looking for volunteers, and they managed to get some short-term people who went in for maybe 6 months. But their terms, they were all either retired and they'd come out of retirement, or they were about to retire. None of them had any interest in staying for very long. So they kind of got things started up, but they were all about to leave, and nobody had signed up to go in there. And we heard about this. And, you know, I don't know. I said to Jennifer, we need to pray about this. And we did. And we just sensed that that was where God wanted us to go. Again, I don't know how to explain it other than it just seemed like that's what we were supposed to do. And so, but we were 2-year volunteers. We were on a limited 2-year term. And normally 2-year people at that time weren't allowed to transfer. They weren't allowed to move. But I went to our supervisor and I said, hey, is it even possible for us to transfer to Bosnia? And he looked at me and said, you know, it's not even possible. We need you. We need people to go down. But there is nobody. You will be the only ones in the country. So we finally decided we'll do it. And so after only about 8 months in Prague, we moved to Bosnia.
And so in Bosnia, you served in 2 places. Is that correct?
Well, we served in a bunch of different places, but we started during our first two-year term, an entire 2 years was supposed to be spent in Prague. But the remaining time of our two-year term, we stayed in the same place. It was a city called Tuzla, which is in the northeast part of Bosnia. It was a very heavily Muslim, mainly like 80% Muslim, maybe 15% Croat, 5% Serb. And
there wasn't a lot of Orthodox influence in that.
No, yeah. Very little. But the funny thing about it is, you know, we had a lot of struggles there, and I outlined these some in the book. We struggled with some Muslim extremists. We struggled with other missionaries. We struggled even the Baptist church there. There was a small Baptist church, and we butted heads. We got kicked out for a while, but they brought us back. But you know, it was really tough. And after a while, Jennifer and I just said, "That's enough." You know, I think we need a break. I think I'll go get a doctorate or something. I'm going to do something besides. I'm not going to re-up immediately, because that's what a lot of people would do, is they do the two-year term to kind of get their feet wet, see how well they could handle missions and get some experience, and then re-up as a career missionary. And that had been our plan all along, but we wavered for a while, and then we finally just decided we didn't know what God wanted us to do. So we said, well, if we haven't received a clear change of direction, we're going to keep going. And we had made friends with people of all three ethnic groups, but it seemed like we clicked with the Serbs the most. We had a lovely, beautiful, wonderful person who was a translator, language teacher. She was Serb, and she loved the Bible. The Bible. She loved the Bible studies that I did. She loved everything about what we were doing, but she would not get baptized. You know, in our understanding of it, she would not become a Baptist. She would not join our church that we were trying to start. She remained devoutly Orthodox, and she actually took me to meet the Orthodox priest there in town. He seemed like a real nice, reasonable guy. And so, you know, he gave me a pretty positive impression of Orthodoxy. She did, and she kind of planted a seed that is going to come up a little bit later. But anyway, we finished up our two-year term. We went home, stayed for about 8 months, had another baby, became career missionaries, and we decided we were going to go back and work with the Bosnian Serbs. So we weren't really sure where to go for a while, but then we thought, well, the Serbs, you know, God just seems to be leading us towards the Serbs. That's what it seemed like. So
you ended up working with Serbs in Bosnia, and
yeah.
What town did you end up working in?
We ended up in the city of Banja Luka, which is in northwest Bosnia, 99% Serb. It's the largest city and the capital of the Serb Republic within Bosnia. I don't know how much your listeners know, but Bosnia structurally or administratively is divided into two halves. One half is called the Muslim Croat Federation, and the other half is called the Serb Republic. The man that just got captured and taken to The Hague, Radovan Karadzic, was the first president of the Serb Republic. Unfortunately, he did a lot of things that were not very nice, to make an understatement. But anyway, we ended up in Banja Luka, and we were there for about 2 months, and then the Kosovo crisis erupted. The Kosovars started rebelling a little bit, and then the Serb government led by Milosevic decided they were going to crush them. So, and then NATO decided to bomb Serbia. So, our supervisors decided that all of our missionary personnel who were in any Serb lands were going to be evacuated. Now you have to understand, we were not being bombed. There were no bombs falling on our heads. They did not bomb Bosnia. They just bombed Serbia proper and Montenegro. But it was feared that there might be reprisals against Americans. So we had about maybe 10 people in Banja Luka, and we had about four adults in Belgrade, and they were all evacuated. So we all kind of ended up all over the place, different places. And we decided to go to Sarajevo because we were committed to one day going back to Banja Luka. Some of the people moved to different countries altogether and just kind of changed their whole focus. But we wanted to work with the Bosnian Serbs. We knew that was our calling. So we moved to Sarajevo temporarily where we could study the language. We actually purposely got a house in an area that was not majority Serb because Sarajevo was heavily Muslim, but it had been majority Serb before the war, and there was still a pretty good Serb presence at that time. This was April of 1999, and we stayed there for about a year and a half. We became fluent in the language, built some relationships, did some Bible studies. I preached a few times and whatnot. And then the year 2000, August, we moved back. It was about a year and a half, less than a year and a half later, we moved back to Banja Luka. It was deemed safe. There had already been one other couple that had been put in Banja Luka, one of the ones that was originally in Belgrade. They moved there, and then we moved there a little bit later. So we had a team of four adult missionaries in Banja Luka. Go back to Banja Luka.
I was going to say, actually, why don't we go back to Sarajevo, because I believe that was your first experience in an Orthodox church there.
Yes, I'm glad you reminded me of that. I had another friend, kind of like our translator in Tuzla. This was a man who loved the Bible. He was trying to learn English. He loved the English language. So we had a lot of connections, and I would go over to his house and do a Bible study just with him and his wife and his son. And we would talk, and, you know, he'd teach me a little bit of their language. I'd teach him some English, and we'd talk about the Bible. And again, he said, well, you know, I like what you're saying. I love the Bible. I love Bible study, but I'm not going to become a Baptist. I'm Orthodox, and I'm not ever going to change. And, again, it's like, why? You know, to me, Orthodoxy just seemed like, you know, just some kind of, I don't know, corrupted form of Christianity. He said, well, why don't you go to my church sometime? I said, okay, why not? So I went, and it was a church, if I remember correctly, I can't remember what I called it in the book, but I think it's just called the Old Church. And it's an old, it really is old. I think it's part of the building dates from the, I don't know, what did I put in the blog? Like
6th century is what you wrote.
6th century, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is not from that period, but the foundation is from the 6th century, and the whole thing is very old. And I went into service, the service itself didn't make much of an impression on me. We got there late, it was dark, it was all in Serbian, I guess some of it was probably in Slavonic, too, and I didn't know what was going on. But, you know, what stuck with me at that point more than the service was his stubborn tenacity holding on to the Orthodox faith. And, that was something that would come up again later after we moved back to Banja Luka.
Now, so let's fast forward. You're in Banja Luka. And what is the impetus for you to start looking at the Orthodox Church?
Yeah, that's a good question. In Banja Luka, over a period from 96 to the year 2000, a four-year period or so, we had sent a dozen or more people, maybe 15, 16 adult missionaries total. Some of them had stayed, you know, 6 months. Some of them had stayed a year, year and a half. We had invested a tremendous amount of personnel, a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of effort, a tremendous amount of money, doing activities, doing Bible studies, witnessing to people, trying to, you know, win people to Christ and so on, and get them baptized and get them into a Baptist Bible study, and which would eventually become a Baptist church. We saw that, and yet there was no lasting fruit from that. There had been, from the beginning of our work there, our organization's work, not my work personally, but from 96 on, there had been about a small Baptist group. You know, they called themselves a church, but it was about five permanent members with maybe occasionally. They'd average maybe two or three or four visitors each time. Never more than 10 people at a time, unless a bunch of missionaries showed up, and then that might double it. But But the fact of the matter is, there had been so much effort and time and money and everything put into Banja Luka. And our missionaries had been really good at starting Bible studies and witnessing the people and getting people to pray the sinner's prayer and to make a decision for Christ. But when it, and they even baptized, quote unquote, baptized a few people. But when it came to, all right, are you ready to join a Baptist church? Then the people would vanish. That was it. You never see them again. And we got to thinking about it. You know, and myself, my wife, and the other couple that we were working with, I'll call them Bob and Melanie, that's what I call them in the book. The four of us, we used to meet together once a week. We would do a devotional, we'd pray, we'd talk. And we said, what is it about this faith, this church, that people are so loyal to it? You know, they will literally fight and die for it. They won't ever darken the door of the church unless there's a funeral or a wedding. I mean, some of them did, obviously, but not too many. The Serbs aren't famous. The Serbs in Bosnia, let me qualify that statement, aren't famous for being big churchgoers. But they're so loyal to Orthodoxy. What is it about this faith that makes them so loyal? We need to study it more. We need to understand these people's mindset. So let's study the faith. Let's take some time and study it individually, come back together, and find out what we learn.
And Father, you started reading some books.
Yes, I did. I pulled out my old copy of the Orthodox Church and read that. And at that point, it made more sense, but it was more like, okay, I agree with this, I agree with this, I don't agree with this, and so on. And it wasn't, you know, it's not designed to be very persuasive. It just presents Orthodoxy as it is. But it helped me understand the faith better. And I didn't really have anything else. My Serbian wasn't really good enough to read a bunch of deep theological books in Serbian. But I was talking to Melanie, the wife and the couple that we worked with, and she just mentioned one day in passing, she said, you know, James, I've got a couple of books about Orthodoxy you might find interesting. And I said, oh, really? What are they? And well, she said, well, one of them's about a bunch of guys that used to be in Campus Crusade for Christ and how they became Orthodox. And I said, no. I said, why would anybody want to do that? Because, I mean, I don't know how it was in your, you were from Calvary Chapel, right?
Yes. And
I don't know. But we saw Southern Baptists, we thought, Campus Crusade people were practically saints.
Well, Campus Crusade was originally headquartered about a mile and a half from my grandparents' house. My grandpa used to keep the power on at the place.
So. Yeah, we saw them. We saw them as a little weak in ecclesiology, but they were just really the Marines, so to speak, of Christianity. So I thought, how in the world could, of all people, Campus Crusade people, how could they do that? How could they weird out like that? So I said, yeah, let me read the book. And I read that thing, you know, about a day. And as I was reading through it, again, of course, the book is Becoming Orthodox, which has been the starting point for thousands and thousands of people in making a pilgrimage to Orthodoxy. And I read through it real quick, and I thought, you know, he raises a few good points, but I don't know. I'm not sure I agree with him completely. Maybe I do a little. I need to do some more reading. So she had another book called Common Ground by Father Jordan Bages. It's published by Light and Life, still available. And it was more more in-depth, a little more scholarly, you know, more, I don't know, maybe it was certainly, it persuaded me about infant baptism. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go back and reread Becoming Orthodox. And I reread it more slowly. And at every point, I just could not refute the arguments that the author, Father Peter Gilquist, makes. You know, I realize, you know, he's right. The early church was liturgical. It was not a bunch of spontaneous, you know, it wasn't spontaneous. The services were not spontaneous like we always thought they were. It was hierarchical, which is also, that flew in the face of Baptist teaching. And it was also sacramental. And that was a hard pill to swallow because, you know, as a good Southern Baptist, I did not believe in sacraments. Sacraments. No, we believed in ordinances, and there were only two, baptism and the Lord's Supper, but they were purely symbolic. They didn't apply any kind of grace toward the believer. So I thought, okay, what about some of these other issues? This is, I think maybe he's right. I need to do more research. And I remember looking at my wife and saying, I said, Jennifer, you know what? I think we might be in the wrong church. And, you know, she has so much wisdom, and she looked at me and she said, you know what, James? Even if you feel called to become an Orthodox priest, I will follow you wherever you want to go. And I said, who said anything about becoming a priest, you know, but yeah, thank you. let's do some more reading. And it just so happened that we had scheduled a month vacation in the U.S. We were going to spend 2 weeks with her parents and 2 weeks with mine. And so I got on the internet and I started ordering books like crazy. You know, I ordered probably 15 books. I had some of them shipped to my parents' house, some of them shipped to hers. And for that whole month we were in the States, I did almost nothing but read. And I forgot to mention, let me back up a step, because we had had, I was kind of the, one of my jobs as a missionary there was as the volunteer coordinator. I was bringing in volunteer groups to come and pray and look around and maybe see how they could get involved more often. And I thought to myself originally, I mean, it was an innocent enough thought. I thought, you know, if these guys are going to come, they need to go to an Orthodox service. They need to see what the only religious option is here. And they need to maybe understand a little about Orthodoxy. So I thought, well, if I'm going to take them to an Orthodox liturgy, I need to go first myself just to make sure I know what's the protocol, what's the etiquette. I didn't want to stick out like a sore thumb. And so I went and visited all by myself one time before the volunteers came. This was about the same time I was reading Becoming Orthodox, back maybe October of 2000. And I went in there, and I got there, you know, 5 minutes early, like a good Baptist, and I'm walking up to the church, and I see a big old crowd, TV station vans, I see big closed-circuit TV cameras, I see this big hustle and bustle and this big crowd, and I think, what in the heck's going on? And the next thing I know, here comes this procession just marching up to the church, and there were, you know, several bishops, you know, a dozen or so priests, deacons, more altar servers than you can shake a stick at. That's a southern phrase, by the way. And incense and, you know, candles and icons and banners and just everything. And I just, wow, I'd never seen anything like that. You know, here, I'm a Baptist preacher from Texas. And here come all these guys with their beautiful vestments, and they march into the church, and then the crowd follows them in, and I got in, and we went in, and I was really impressed. And what I didn't realize at the time is that they were celebrating, they had a triple celebration. They were celebrating 2,000 years of Christianity, 1,000 years of Christianity among the Serbs, and 100 years of the local diocese, the Banja Luka diocese. And then the liturgy started, and I was blown away. Wow, now this is worship. You know, like the turtle in Finding Nemo, Crush. He says, well, you were like, whoa, and we were like, whoa. I mean, that's how I felt, whoa. And there was incense, and there were icons from ceiling to floor, and, you know, just the chanting, and the choir was majestic, and it was, I said, now this is worship. You know, I felt almost like the guys from Prince Vladimir, who went and visited Constantinople, and they said, we knew not whether this was heaven or earth. And that's how I felt. I know a lot of people, you know, kind of get blown away in a negative way, that they kind of, you know, I guess they have sensory overload, or they really don't always have the best experience their first time, but I was just smitten. I mean, it was love at first sight. Because I'd been going to a Baptist service that was in a small room with four white walls, where we would have a prayer, we'd sing three or four little praise courses if I brought my guitar and led them. If I didn't, we'd just skip that. And then we'd have a sermon that was about an hour long, like another prayer, and that was it. You know, and this was just so rich. The other was so dry, and this was so rich. And I said, Jennifer, you got to come see this. I got to go again. You know, I took the two volunteer groups, and then I took Jennifer once. Now, granted, her experience wasn't quite as positive as me, because she said all I could see was the backs of people's heads. She was a little shorter than me. I'm 6'2", and she's about 5'2". But But she was also, I forgot to mention, she was reading the books too, and she wasn't far behind me. You know, I was really blessed in that, you know, God seemed to work in her heart at about the same time as me.
That's great. And so you guys are back in the States, you're on your hiatus, and you visited another Orthodox church in America?
We did. You know, my buddy Bob, our partner there, our team member, they had read the books, and they had kind of been attracted to Orthodoxy a little bit, too, not as much as us. But they, at one point, he looked me in the eye, and he said, I said, man, we might just end up going Orthodox. And he said, well, we might just go with you. But later, he kind of cooled off a little, and he said to me once, well, you know, okay, you've been to the liturgy half a dozen times here in Banja Luka, and it's a beautiful church, the choir's great, everything's terrific, you know, this is a traditionally Orthodox land, but if you become Orthodox, you're going to have to go back to America. You know, what if you go back and it's not everything that you thought it was going to be? So I said, yeah, he's got a good point, so I better visit the service when I'm in the States. So when we were staying with my parents, they lived north of Houston, about 30 miles north. We visited St. Anthony the Great Antiochian Church in Spring. And, you know, obviously it wasn't quite like the church in Bosnia, but it was still beautiful. You know, I thought, yes, this is it. It doesn't matter where it is. The music is beautiful. The liturgy is beautiful. It's just full. The faith is full. And all the while, like I said, I was reading all these books. I read books like, I read Clark Carlton's books, all four of them. Especially The Way was very influential for me. And after I read The Way, I said, that's it, Jennifer. I'm done. I'm not a Baptist anymore. I'm Orthodox. But then we had to go back.
You went back to Bosnia, and how did that go?
Yeah, how did that go? Well, I was very conflicted. And Jennifer, again, she was with me all the way. We were on the same page. And I said, Jennifer, what am I going to do? I'm Orthodox in heart, but here I am. I'm being paid by the Southern Baptist Convention to win people to Jesus and start Baptist churches. And I don't know what to do. And I thought about it, and I said, I've got the solution. I said, I'm going undercover. I said, I'm going to, be secretly Orthodox in my heart, but I'll just continue to do my job as a good, happy Baptist.
So closet Orthodox.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I always liked spy movies and spy stories and whatnot, so I thought, well, I'll just be a secret agent of the Orthodox Church. And she said, that's not going to work. You know, sometimes we don't listen to our wives. We should. The longer I've been married, the more I've learned how important it is to listen to her. But at the time, we'd been married, I guess, about 10, almost 11 years. And I said, nah, I'm still going to try to do this. You know, I said, hey, we've got two kids to take care of. We were making, you know, we didn't make a huge salary, but all of our expenses were paid. It was kind of like being in the military. We didn't pay for housing. We didn't pay for car insurance, all that. So we were saving a lot of money each month, and I thought, this is a good living. We loved Banja Luka. We loved the people. We knew the language. We understood the culture. We loved the food. And everything was good. Life was beautiful. And now we had this big problem. Now I realized I couldn't really quite do my job anymore, at least as I was supposed to. And I said to Bob when he came back, I said, I told him what I was going to do, and he said, that's not going to work. Same thing my wife had said, but you know, to my shame, I listened to him a little bit more. I had just been made a supervisor, by the way, which I did not mention, but and I was going to have people coming. We had more missionaries in the pipeline coming that were going to be under my supervision. And I was also about to have to go to a conference for supervisors in Prague, of all places. And Bob said to me, he said, when you go to this conference, because he had just gotten back, he said, when you go to this conference, you're going to have to write out your plan for winning Banja Luka to Christ. And you're going to have to come up with a strategy for planting churches among all the Bosnian Serbs and so on and so on. He said, you're not going to be able to do that, are you? And I said, no, I'm not. And I had already bought my plane ticket. So I went and got a refund. I called my boss, and I said to him, Ted, I'm not going to that conference in Prague, and I want to come up there and talk to you about it. And he said, okay. So we drove up to our supervisor was in Zagreb, Croatia, about a 2-hour drive from where we were. And I said to him, Ted, I'm not going to beat around the bush with you. I was there with Jennifer and with Bob, and he and his wife were there. I said, the reason I'm not going to the conference is because Jennifer and I have decided to become Orthodox. We're going to convert to the Orthodox Church, and we're going to resign, and we're going to go home.
And how was that reaction?
It was not good. Let me put it that way. He looked as if I had said, you know, if I had said, Ted, I've just murdered 50 people and I'm on the run from the Banja Luka police, I don't think he would have been any more shocked. He might have actually preferred that. He was stunned, and he just said, you can't do this. And he started trying to talk me out of it, and he would go on and on and on, and he'd talk, and he'd say, well, what about this? And I'd answer him, and he'd go, well, what about this? And I'd answer, and he was getting angry, and he was on the verge of tears. At one point, he ran out of the room, and he grabbed a paper he had written in seminary about all the alleged errors of the Orthodox Church, and he said, hey, well, read this. And I skimmed through it real quick, and I said, no, that doesn't affect my decision. I don't agree with what you said here. And he said, well, the funny thing about it is, he said, well, the Orthodox Church, they don't even believe in the Augustinian foundation of Christianity. And I thought, what do you mean Augustinian foundation? What about the 300 or so, 400 years before Augustine? I mean, he thought Augustine basically
invented Christianity.
The church.
Yeah.
And he said, well, what do they think about the 5 points of Calvinism? And I said, well, I think they're opposed to all 5 of them. And he said, well, that bothers me even more than the fact that you're not going to be Orthodox. I mean, the fact that you're converting to Orthodoxy bothers me less than the fact that you don't believe in the 5 points of Calvinism. I mean, he was losing it. He was so distraught. And he finally said, well, why don't you just try to open up the Orthodox branch of the International Mission Board? That was the new name of the board. I said, Ted, I cannot do that. I cannot take a salary from all these little old ladies who are giving their savings to the mission board to support missionaries. I cannot do that. I cannot in good conscience accept this salary. I have to do it. And he finally gave up.
And so you packed your bags and headed back to Beverly Hills, Texas.
Yeah. That's funny. It's funny that you said that, because the name of the intermediate school my oldest daughter ended up attending was Beverly Hills. But yeah, we moved back, and I had taught school for 3 years at a private Christian school while I was in seminary to help put myself through. So I decided I was going to teach school. So I got a job teaching math, you know, because I had all those engineering hours and everything. I was pretty good with math and science. So I ended up teaching math. And at the same time, we joined St. Joseph, same church where I am now as the assistant priest. We stepped in there as inquirers, and then we became catechumens shortly afterward, and we were received into the Orthodox Church by chrismation in April of 2002, right before Pascha.
Wonderful. And then what led you to becoming a priest?
Well, I tell you what, this is something I neglected to mention earlier, but one of the books I read was At the Corner of East and Now by Frederica Matthews Green. Great book. And there's one point in the book where she is talking about the proscomedia service, and she mentions the lines that the priest says when he is cutting the lamb out of the piece of bread. For those who don't know, the lamb is a square-shaped piece of bread that eventually becomes the body of Christ during the liturgy. But when the priest is preparing that and cutting it out of the larger loaf, he says the lines from Isaiah. He says, as a sheep led to the slaughter, so he opened not his mouth. As a blameless lamb before its shear was dumb, so he opened not his mouth. I'm sorry, I misquoted it. And it says, who can describe his generation, for his life is taken up from the earth. And as I was reading those lines, again, Jacob, I don't know why it is, but I guess it's because I'm such a nerd, I'm such a bookworm, but I just felt like God was speaking to me through that book and saying, you're going to be a priest, that you're going to be doing that one day. And so that was how I sensed a calling into the priesthood, not just to become Orthodox, but to become a priest. So, you know, I shared this with my pastor, Father Matthew McKay, and he said, well, you need to enroll in the St. Stephen's program. That's a program of correspondence studies, which, you know, can lead to the priesthood for some. For others, it leads to the diaconate. For others, it's just a way of deepening your knowledge of Orthodoxy. So I started the course in the fall of 02, about a year after I, well, less than a year after I was chrismated, and I finished it in 05. During about 2 years into it, my bishop and Father Matthew decided that it was time for me to become a deacon. So I was ordained as a deacon in August of 04, and I served in that capacity for about a year and a half. And then, I guess around the fall of 05, my bishop, Bishop Basil of Wichita in America, decided it was time for me to become a priest. So I'd already finished a three-year program by then, the St. Stephen's program. So I was ordained as a priest on February 12th of 06 and assigned as the assistant priest of St. Joseph. And I'm not really paid. I receive a small stipend from the church, but I still work a full-time job. I work for the school district.
Got it. And Father, a couple of last follow-up questions. How did your in-laws or your parents, your friends around you react to you becoming Orthodox?
That's a good question. My parents, as I mentioned early on, by this point, they were very elderly. My father, sadly, had Alzheimer's disease. He came down with it about 96 or so. So he had no idea really what was going on at all. My mother she seemed interested in it. She had kind of grown closer to the Lord. She was still Episcopalian, but had kind of gotten real involved in evangelical Bible studies and whatnot. Sadly, my mother had a stroke in 01, not long after we came home, and she passed away in... I think it was 2 or 3 days before we were chrismated. So we had our chrismation, and that very evening we had the viewing service, and the next day was her funeral. So my parents really didn't have, you know, that much time or ability to react. My wife's parents, my wife's father is a Baptist preacher. He still is. He's been doing that for close to 30 years, or maybe over 30 years. He went to the same seminary I did. And we just kind of had to agree to disagree. You know, at first they were excited. They were just excited we were coming home. Mm-hmm. And they were never really all that crazy about us being in Bosnia, you know. So, they were glad that we came home. And then kind of once it sunk in that we weren't Baptists and we were serious about this Orthodoxy thing, we had a few discussions, and then he kind of said, that's enough. No more discussion. So we don't really discuss theology a whole lot. It's kind of like a truce. As far as our friends, most of our friends at that time were our missionary colleagues. And I thought, I was pretty naive. I thought, man, if I just give them all the same books, if they read the same books and go through the same process I did, you know, I studied early church history like a lot of people and realized what the fathers taught and how it was close to orthodoxy, essentially. I said, if I just point them to the same sources I had, they'll all convert. So I started handing out books. I bought up all these books. I handed them out to my friends, and they politely read them, or at least took them, but they didn't convert. Some of them just said, hey, we applaud your courage, although we disagree with you. Others wouldn't talk to us anymore. But for the most part, I have to say this, too, that the mission board treated us very graciously. They were very kind to us. They gave us a little extra medical insurance, which got us through the birth of our third child. And so I want to say that the Southern Baptist International Mission Board is very kind and good to its people. I know other missionaries who have gone through a similar experience who have been cut off completely and said, oh, well, I hope you can get your way home.
Well, thank God for their kindness and generosity. Well, Father, would you give us a blessing as we wrap up this episode of Journeys to Orthodoxy?
I will. I thank you. Thank you for having me on your show, and I pray that others will find this talk helpful. And I pray that the Lord will bless and keep all of you who are listening. May he make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. Amen.
Amen. And Father, your blog is, again, for our listeners?
Yes, the blog is called St. James Kids. The easiest way to find it is to Google F.R. James Early. Don't spell out Father, just put F.R. James Early, and my last name is spelled just like early in the morning. Think 5 a.m.
And your forthcoming book is?
It is From Baptist to Bosnia to Byzantium by Regina Orthodox Press. Should be out in January of 2009.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Father.
Thank you. May the Lord bless you, Jacob.
Thank you for listening to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. If you would like to share your journey with us, please do so at journeys@iconnewmedianetwork.com. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net. Journeys to Orthodoxy is sponsored by ExistDesigns.com. If it's not online, it doesn't exist. ExistDesigns.com.
Well, Jolene unlocked the thick breezeway door.